Heldman.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Sam Heldman for Dr. Sharon Heron-Williams. Title VII, summary judgment case, largely, though not totally, about retaliation. I think there's a couple of most interesting, obviously I want to talk about whatever the court wants to talk about. To me, the most interesting and substantive questions are...
Well, one of my concerns is that her complaints were just broad brushed on every conceivable Title VII basis. Race, sex, pay, in a sort of a broad brush.
Is the court speaking of the email protected activity?
When she made the claim of the of discrimination, it was broad brush.
I see. I think I understand the court is talking about
very, very
the
broad
activity in which she mentioned several possible acts of discrimination.
And so she's describing what happened on these other occasions in a broad brush sense.
She does say, these are things that have happened to me.
Because of boom, 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 boom.
And that's right. And she says, you know, age, ethnicity, but also she says race and sex.
I understand.
And those, I think, ultimately pan out to be the probably correct answer on the discrimination, or the most likely correct. We do know, after all, that Provost Wilson was trying to lure white male Dr. Haverin back out of retirement to take over when my client, Dr. Heron-Williams, hadn't been told she was doing anything wrong. Nobody had ever said, hey, you know, you're doing this poorly, you're doing that poorly, yet she catches wind that for inexplicable reasons, they're trying to lure the other guys back. At the same time, for inexplicable reasons, she can't get the president to do the simple thing of signing the president's name on a form that she's emailed to the president to designate her as a PDSO, which is key to her job. And so she's frustrated. And so she says in this August email, these things are happening, and, you know, I just have to believe, I'm not quoting directly, I'm paraphrasing, I just have to believe that the actions of Provost Wilson and others, perhaps others, and she's sort of suggesting perhaps the president too, can only be based on gender, age or educational background, if not race and ethnicity. So yes, that is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things.
And she also says hostile work environment, right?
She does say hostile work environment. I don't.
That is. That's kind of a shotgun approach.
I don't know if she meant that in a Title VII sense, or in the more colloquial sense. That's not what I'm really hanging my hat on for this to be protected activity. I do suggest to the court that when somebody says I have a series of complaints, and I think it is, among other things, race or sex discrimination, but that's protected activity. Now, if the employer then wants to come along and say, well, I didn't fire you because you said race or sex discrimination, I fired you because you said educational background discrimination, and that's not a protected nexus under Title VII, ha-ha, you don't really have a Title VII claim. Well, we could fight that out, but the employer's not saying that, of course.
So to Judge Choflat's point, though, is it enough for protected activity purposes for her just to kind of lob these bombs, the kind of the buzz phrases in, race, sex, hostile work environment, these sorts of things, without any sort of... And again, I guess now I don't mean to use that in a sort of term of art sense, but a colloquial sense, without any backup to support those allegations.
Right. Well, what we remember is when we're talking about retaliation and opposition, we're talking about the workplace. And although we're talking about a university here, we're also talking about, you know, people who work at the Quickie Mart and Fish Diggers. I don't think there's any law, I've never seen a case that says when you complain about what you perceive as discrimination, you must do it in an erudite fashion and note bullet points about why you think it is that.
There's no, I think that's certainly not the law.
And she does. Any reasonable reader in the president's and the provost's position would understand when she's talking about Dr. Havran in particular, they're trying to bring Dr. Havran back into my place. This is, I think, sex and race discrimination. Anybody in context knows, yeah, well, Dr. Havran, he was a white man. That's why she's saying that. That's a reasonable inference. But we don't have any sort of pleading standard or evidentiary burden standard in making an initial internal Title VII opposition.
But there is some floor, right? I mean, so we've got this case called Clover versus Total Systems. I think you guys briefed it, where we said it's not sufficient for retaliation purposes, where the complaint of conduct sort of misses the discrimination mark by a country mile.
By a country mile.
So, I mean, there is some threshold over which you have to get before your retaliation sort of triggers Title VII scrutiny, right?
There certainly is in some areas. If you say, I think that you discriminated against me because my name starts with an H and that violates Title VII, well, that just doesn't violate Title VII and nobody could think it does.
But as soon as you say race or gender, you're on.
Well, I think we do also have the subjective belief test, and there's no doubt that she did have the subjective.
Oh, that's all over the case. Did she, when she complained, that the protective activity, did she say they are trying to bring in Havlin on racial grounds, racial and sexual grounds?
I believe that that is a fair.
No. Did she explicitly say that?
She did not put Havlin and race and sex in the same sentence.
Did she even mention him?
Yes, she did mention him. Yes.
And what'd she say about him?
She said, and this is among other places, document 29.3. Dr. 29-3, page 41. I've also been told that Dr. Wilson tried to bring Dr. Havran back to the university.
She was told. Yeah, who did she say that to?
She was told that.
No. Who did she? When she made the complaint.
This is to the president, President Boyd.
Yeah.
So she complained to Boyd, president.
And Boyd, she told Boyd that they're trying to bring Havran back in and that's discriminatory.
She says on page 41, this is among other things to add. This is among the things I'm complaining about.
No. I'm looking for what she said specifically to Boyd.
I'm sorry if I'm being...
I understand she's complaining about that, but what was communicated to Boyd about race and sex?
Okay, and that's what I'm trying to answer and doing a poor job of it. This is an email to Boyd that I'm looking at and quoting from. She's talking about Havran as one of the series of things, and then on the next and final page of her email is when she says, I can only infer, and again, I'm paraphrasing, that this is discrimination. Now, again, the district court said, yeah, but she didn't have enough evidence that there was real discrimination.
That's her subjective reaction.
The district court said, objectively, that's not enough. And I say...
No, that was her subjective reaction. She assumed that.
That was her belief.
Subjective
belief.
Yeah.
The district court says yes, but there was not enough objective evidence underlying her subjective reaction. I say, first of all, we shouldn't require very much of employees to be able to bring their subjective good faith beliefs up. If you say,
what would you expect Boyd to do in response to that, her subjective belief?
I would expect a good employer would A, investigate. I would
no, but no.
B,
I understand. Where was Boyd to go?
Boyd should have asked the Provost Wilson.
Yeah.
About it. Why'd you do that? She did.
Okay.
The main thing, the main thing I would expect President Wilson not to do is not to preside over a system that has my client then within weeks later losing not one but two assignments at the loss of money. Within weeks of this, she loses not one but two other jobs, which then cascades into a...
Well, one of the jobs, the contract went out.
But we all know from the Quinn case and others, just because a contract runs out, she's been on a series of renewal contracts. Your contract ran out and we didn't renew it, that's an adverse action. Then the question is why, and there is no evidence of a legitimate reason of why. President, you asked the president in the deposition, why'd you do that? I can't remember. Why didn't you want her to be your faculty athletic representative? No reason. On the other one, and you know, I'm going to be quick on this. On the OMIA, you have the provost, Dr. Wilson, swearing in interrogatory answers that no one decided not to give her the PDSO designation. And they only fired her because she couldn't get it. And then, in his deposition, he swears under oath to a completely different story. No, the president decided not to give it to her because the president didn't want to give it to a to an interim. And then I caught wind from that. Well, clearly the president doesn't like her, and so I let her go. And then, in an affidavit, he says, no, we wanted to get rid of her so we could expedite the process of hiring somebody else, which is a complete non sequitur. So I say, on the protected activity part, an employer should not be allowed by law to fire somebody for writing even an inexact letter that says, I hate these things that are going on. I think they're probably race and sex.
Well, she wasn't fired. She just wasn't renewed with the OMIA.
Correct. But I was speaking, Your Honor, and I'm sorry to interrupt. I was speaking to the point of, is it protected activity? So, yes. Firing or others, the same. But you're right, she was not fired. So if people can lose parts or all of their jobs for saying politely, this junk is going on and it's inexplicable and they're trying to bring the white male in and I smell discrimination. If you can be fired for that because it's not protected activity, I do not understand Title VII law.
Okay. Thank you. You've saved some rebuttal time.
Yes.
May it please the court. I'm Ramadana Jones, and I, along with Kenneth Thomas, we represent Alabama State University. And, Your Honor, I'll go right into the protected activity or the alleged protected activity. On August 6, 2014, Dr. Williams sends an email to Dr. Boyd, and she has a variety of workplace concerns. I want to take my old computer. I don't like the setup that other people have access to Sevis, and I don't. And then this is what she says specifically about Dr. Havron. I've also been told that Dr. Wilson tried to bring Dr. Havron back to the university following the 30-day period required by the retirement systems of Alabama. That's it. And I won't bore you with the nuances of the retirement systems of Alabama, but what she's referring to is a 30-day period after you retire from a state agency. There's a sit-out period before the time you can return back. So she's telling Dr. Boyd, I think there's a problem when Dr. Wilson is asking him to return back to the university before he's completed this 30-day period. There's no reference to, I think this is because Dr. Havron is white, because he's a man, or because I'm black, or because I'm a woman. The reference to Dr. Havron is not even in the same sentence regarding her allegation of discrimination. It's not even on the same page. She concludes her four-page email with the statement that she has no other reason but to assume that these workplace things that she disagrees with are occurring because of gender, age, educational
and that,
background.
That included the computer and all those other things.
Yes, race, ethnicity, and then she throws in hostile work environment. She just throws everything covered by Title VII up against the wall to see what will stick. And it's just not the law of this circuit that that's protected activity. There is a test to determine whether one has engaged in protected activity, and that's that reasonable, subjective, and objective belief. And the district court determined that she did not demonstrate such belief.
Neither subjective nor objective, or that her subjective belief was not objectively reasonable?
Maybe a little of both. But I would say that maybe that her subjective belief was not objectively.
Well, what she said, a subjective belief had no punch, no probative value.
Right.
It wasn't worth much.
Right. And another fact that goes towards that is that if you look at Dr. Williams' deposition, particularly on page 68 and 69 of her deposition, the whole reason that she found out that Dr. Wilson asked Dr. Haveron to come back is in a conversation with Dr. Haveron. Dr. Williams says she commonly consulted with Dr. Haveron because not only was he the last person in international affairs, he was the only person who had served as the director of international affairs at Alabama State University. So it's okay for her to consult with Dr. Haveron about, hey, how do I operate in this office? But it's discrimination when Dr. Wilson says, hey, can you just come take your job back? And that's not discrimination.
Well, there's a big difference between just consulting with questions versus, hey, would you want your old job back and ousting Ms. Williams?
Well, and then when you look at the time frame, when she's complaining to Dr. Boyd, she's saying that Dr. Wilson asked him to come back before his 30-day time period. And the evidence is in the record that Dr. Haveron retired somewhere around March or April. Here it is in August that she's talking about this. But she's saying she commonly consults with this man. So, in other words, he is needed. She needed him to perform her interim duties in international.
She says is what she needed is this PDSO designation, this Principal Designated School Official designation, so she could process visas for the foreign students. And she never got that, did she?
No, she didn't. And that's her opinion that she couldn't process visas. It is undisputed in the record that there were two other people working at Alabama State University who had access to the SEVA system who were charged with completing those items for Homeland Security. Her complaint to Dr. Boyd was, this is frustrating and I don't like the process. So it wasn't discriminatory towards her. It's also undisputed in the record that the two women who had the access to the SEVA system were two black females. But
didn't the university officials give conflicting reasons as to why she did not get this PDSO designation while she was in charge of this, the Office of Minority and International Affairs?
I would say the reason given is one and the same. Dr. Williams says that ASU gave one reason to the EEOC, and that was she could not obtain the PDSO designation. And on summary judgment, ASU cited to the court that Dr. Boyd did not want to give this PDSO designation to an interim person. So while she is serving interim duties, she could not obtain the PDSO designation. But it is undisputed in the record that there were people who had access to this system who could complete the given tasks needed.
Did the person who immediately followed her get the PDSO?
No, the person who immediately followed her was another interim person, Carol Williams. She didn't have the PDSO designation either.
Got it. And is that because she was interim? Is that did that continue to be the reason she didn't get the PDSO? Because she likewise was interim?
As far as I know, Your Honor, there was never, I don't know if that's fleshed out in the record as specific as that, but we know she was interim, and we know that she was not given a PDSO designation.
Got it.
So because Dr. Williams did not engage in protected activity, she could not be subjected to retaliation in reference to the removal from the international affairs or the expiration of her FAR contract or the faculty athletic representative contract.
What do you think, because Mr. Heldman's position is, for something to constitute protected activity for retaliation purposes, it doesn't have to be Cicero. It's got to be kind of good enough. And he says that what's here, and even if there isn't like really a close connection between what she says about Haveron and the race and gender allegations, it's sort of good enough, and we ought to be pretty indulgent with respect to those sorts of allegations. What do you think is, where's the bar? Where's the line? What should she, what did she need to do to make this protected activity?
Well, I think she would have needed to give facts to Dr. Boyd, which would place her on notice that she's complaining about racial or gender discrimination related to Dr. Haveron. Again, Dr. Haveron just happened to be white and male. I mean, but he was just the last person who held that position. If you look at Jefferson versus C1, the case that Dr. Williams cited in her brief, the court held that the employee in that case had a reasonable belief that they were engaging in protected activity because days prior, the supervisor told her, hey, we're filling this position with a Korean person. And Dr. Williams doesn't have anything close to that. There's no evidence in the record that ASU was out on this grand plan to fill this position with a white male.
Well, let's see. Isn't it a fact that she sends this August 6, 2014 email to Dr. Boyd? About 5 weeks later is when she's removed from her supervisory position with the OMIA, right? So there's some temporal proximity there.
I would argue that it's not. I mean, she sends this email August 6, 2014. On September 15th, a little over a month and a half later, she is then removed from her interim assignment in international affairs. But ASU had a legitimate non-retaliatory reason for that removal, and that was to accelerate the process of putting a permanent director of international affairs in that position.
But it took them over a year to actually fill the position with even another interim person, didn't it?
Unfortunately, yes, Your Honor. Well, to fill it with a permanent person. It's undisputed. In fact, one of the things that Dr. Williams is complaining of in her August 6, 2014 email is that I shouldn't even have to interview for the permanent director of international affairs. So there's evidence that shows ASU was already in the process of trying to fill this with a permanent director. And it's also undisputed that they had made a selection for the permanent director. That person just decided not to take the position.
Well, you know, let me ask you this. Is it accurate that the district court decided that there was that Dr. Williams had not even established a prima facie case of retaliation?
Yes.
And if that's so, I mean, is one possibility that if she didn't get the other steps, beyond that, if we think that there's enough evidence of a prima facie case, should we remand for the district court to complete its analysis?
Well, I don't think so. I think the district court did establish that she didn't establish a, well, the district court did decide that she didn't establish a prima facie case, but the district court did also examine those other portions of ASU's argument. The district court does say that, you know, it is undisputed that ASU was in the process of trying to make a permanent appointment, but for whatever reasons, that person didn't select the job. Those things are in the record and were already examined by the district court.
But isn't there some case law in the 11th Circuit that says that if you've got a qualified person for the position, and presumably there's no reason to believe that Dr. Williams wasn't qualified, and you have a long gap before you're to fill the position, that can be some evidence of discrimination?
I don't think that alone is evidence of discrimination. Their claim is not that because it took such a long time to fill this position, there's discrimination. They're claiming discrimination in the interim appointment.
My understanding is there is no claim in this case, basically, that any of these episodes, standing alone, violated Title VII.
Correct.
Okay. We don't give you a computer, but we would give you a computer somebody not protected. You're protected, you don't get, or all those things. Everything hangs on the retaliation. Everything hangs on the complaint that everything that's happening to me is discriminatory.
Right.
So now that I've complained, anything that happens, even though it in and of itself doesn't violate Title VII, is retaliatory in violation of Title VII. That's what I understand the plaintiff's case to be.
Yes, that is.
If you squeeze it down, that's what it is.
Yes. Now, and they have also alleged that the alleged reach out to Dr. Havron was also racial and gender discrimination.
Yeah, but that's just reaching out and nothing happened.
Right.
And not so that there's not. If they had reached out and appointed him and discharged her, you got a Title VII case. Just reaching out is nothing.
I agree with you, okay. Your Honor. The reaching out is nothing, but it's upon that reach out that she's based her retaliation.
She bases her claims on, I told Boyd everything that's happening to me in effect is in violation of Title VII. on all kind of grounds.
Well, no, they specifically say that the statement regarding Dr. Havron in her email is what was the protected activity.
Well, you know, I understand. Everything was a protected activity, all of her complaints to Boyd.
Right.
Okay. So that what happened afterwards is in retaliation, even though what happened afterwards was not discriminatory in itself. Am I off base?
No. And that's what we argue, that is, number one, it's not retaliatory, but again, it's not discriminatory. And the plaintiff just did not have produced any evidence upon which a reasonable jury could conclude that ASU either retaliated against Dr. Williams or discriminated against Dr. Williams. Are there any other questions from the
court? I think we have your case.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Heldman.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Just a couple things that I'd like to affirmatively say and then answer the court's questions. My friend began by suggesting...
Which of these episodes that she complains about could amount to a Title VII claim independently? Which ones?
You're talking about, if the court is talking about...
Now forget the complaints to Dr. Boyd or anybody else. She complains of these episodes.
And by complains, the court means in the email to...
No. She's alleging discrimination in some of these things.
I think we're on the
same page. And what I want to know is, if you eliminate any if you eliminate from the case that she complained that she was being discriminated against, never made a claim of discrimination, could she make out a Title VII claim on any of the episodes that are retaliatory?
Okay. There is a discrimination claim in this case.
I understand that. All I want to know is, if you take away the retaliation theory, which of the claims constitutes a violation independently of Title VII? Take the computer equipment.
Okay. I'm not suggesting that one could bring a Title VII claim, and she didn't bring a Title VII claim.
I want to know if she could bring one on any of those by themselves.
She could and did.
Okay, which ones? Pick them out.
She could and did bring a Title VII claim about her removal from OMIA, and part of the evidence
What would the allegation on the removal from OMIA be?
The allegation...
No retaliation, just discriminatory.
The allegation, Your Honor, and it's not my main claim, but it is a claim. We know that she has a prima facie case on that. How do we...
Tell me, was she replaced by somebody?
The prima facie case, Your Honor, comes from two prongs, if I may. Number one, the effort to replace her with the white man. The effort itself, not actionable, but the effort itself bespeaks intent to a prima facie.
Wait a minute. The effort didn't cost her anything.
But it is indicative of intent, Your Honor.
I understand that. Give me. Something happened, and there's a comparator. It wouldn't have happened to somebody else.
Second, Your Honor, the prima facie case comes, as Judge Gilman said, there is 11th Circuit law, and we cite it in our brief, that if you have a qualified person who wants a position and isn't given it, and they hold it open and keep asking for more, that's a prima facie case.
Then they filled it with somebody else.
2 years later.
Okay.
Then you get to Y, and we're on pretext.
That's your Title VII claim.
That's our Title VII discrimination claim.
Okay.
Now, if I may...
It was held open to put a white person in.
It was
white male.
To put a white person or a male, that would be up to the jury to decide.
I understand. Okay.
Or maybe they just ultimately couldn't find who they wanted, but their intent as to not putting her in.
Okay.
Let me get back to what I wanted to say about my counsel said, she just threw this up against the wall to see what would stick. We're on summary judgment. That is not an undisputed fact.
The jury can look at this letter where in the paragraph right before she says race and sex discrimination, she's talking about how they tried to get somebody in to take the job who hadn't even applied. Just right before that. Now, she has her affidavit that says it was my good faith subjective belief. So no, we cannot approach this case as though she threw things up against the wall in a self-protective, ha-ha, now you can't do anything to anybody.
Thank you very much. The red light's on.
Thank you.
Court will be in recess till 9 in the morning.
All right.